Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today it's my pleasure to have Bernard Cooper on the show. His most recent book is a book of short stories called Guess Again. When he began, he had written a book of prose poems and poetic essays called Maps to Anywhere. It was followed by the novel A Year of Rhymes, a book of memoirs and essays called Truth Serum, and, as I said, the book of stories, Guess Again, published by Simon & Schuster. Now, I'm aware from having read your work that even before you began writing fiction, there was artwork. You began as a visual artist. I believe you mentioned in Truth Serum a friend coming to read your poem, so there was poetry. Then there's a novel, memoirs, a short story, and I gather that you've begun writing art criticism for Los Angeles Magazine. In finding forms that you feel comfortable with, what causes you to make a change or move restlessly from one form to another, and have you found a favorite form?
I was very involved in the visual arts for most of my life. And I studied conceptual art in the 1970s at the California Institute of the Arts, which was at that time the most avant-garde art school in the country. People were doing things like falling asleep in the gallery as their graduate show, things of that nature. And I was using text in my visual art. And what I began to realize more and more was that the imagery or the physicality of the work could be conjured through language alone. So my step from architecture and the visual arts, from objects to literature to writing, may seem like a huge leap. I know it does to a lot of people, but as I'm sure you'll understand, for me it's very much part of a continuum. So I'm aware both of leaping from one form to another, and then within literature from one genre to another. And yet, in some sense, there seems to be a through line, as they say in Hollywood. And I think one of the reasons that my interests in general have been varied and that the genres that I've worked in literature have been varied is because I work so much by instinct. I feel so much that I am following my nose and I'm trying to figure out what the best form is for a particular idea.
In my favorite of the stories in Guess Again, the new collection by my guest Bernard Cooper, published by Simon & Schuster, and by the way, you're listening to Bookworm, I'm Michael Silverblatt. My favorite story is called Old Birds, and characteristically, the narrator is talking to his father, who says, essentially, I guess I'm just an old bird, or we're old birds. And the narrator, an architect, begins to think, since he's designing an old age home, wouldn't it be nice to have the old and birds together? And he imagines an aviary in the middle of the home, and bringing in an expert about birds in order to build this home, he meets his lover-to-be. But the stories all seem to have that link and bobble-link of pawning language followed by embodied concept followed by action. Between the Sheets, too, begins with a story about sheets, but before long there's a joke and a word game involving sheets. So I wondered about how you find these sparks that seem to generate entire stories.
Well, I would also add to that there's another story called What to Name the Baby, which has to do with names, and that also is very much generated by language. I think, I mean, probably obviously it arises out of my interest in the lyricism and musicality and, you know, in the phrases and figures of speech that are around us all the time and in single words themselves. You know, it's funny. I don't necessarily set out to do that, but I think that in the process of writing, I become enchanted with certain words and phrases, as do the characters. And I think a lot of the motivation or momentum for the stories comes out of the characters' desires to understand each other in a really literal sense, to be on the same page, so to speak, when they are addressing each other, to understand and grasp what kind of interior world they're able to make or convey through language.
Well, in that story that you mentioned, What to Name the Baby, there's an exact example of what I'm talking about, but it doesn't occur inside the story. It occurs outside it in the creation of the story, in a sense. Two men, a poet, and what is the other one by profession?
An architect.
An architect, of course. They have bought a mobile home. One of their daughters, by a previous marriage, pregnant, is traveling with them. In many ways, the subject of the story is mobile homes. They're in a mobile home. The girl is herself a mobile home for the infant growing inside her. And before long in the story, a character has to hitchhike for gas, and he's picked up by a semi that has hooked to the back half of an actual house that's being moved, literally a mobile home. And it's sort of as if the story, which you're reading, I'm going along in it saying, I kind of think something is going on here about transiency and moving from place to place. And then suddenly, out of the blue, the main character is literally being picked up hitchhiking by a house. How does this happen?
You know, I do think that in the process of understanding the character's yearnings, the phrase mobile home really did encapsulate in some way the conflicts that each was experiencing, being in some kind of limbo between finding a home and moving into directions that were unpredictable for them. Maybe even shedding what their idea of home previously was.
The stories have not only themes, but more than many stories, what I would call universal themes. And the first of them that I'd like to talk to you about is the idea of home itself, of having a home, because from the very first book, there's, to my mind, well, you'll pardon my extremity here, but I've listed one of my guest Bernard Cooper's longer pieces called The House of the Future among the best novella-length pieces of the century. I count it with as much affection, for instance, as I think of some of Catherine Ann Porter's stories. I think it's a really achieved piece. But it's about the projections of the future borne by houses at a world's fair. But your characters tend to be architects, the owning of homes, the moving from homes, being confined to homes, and even the father in Old Birds thinks about buying a casket the way you think about buying a piece for the home. He says it's as nice as a piano, and offers the son a casket on a two-for-one sale. So I wanted to talk to you about that impulse toward and away from security.
Well, I think you nailed it right there. It is this impulse toward and away from security. And, you know, without getting too psychological about this, really my first passion, my first inclination toward anything aesthetic was an interest in architecture. And I have very distinct memories of, well, first of all, being captivated by floor plans, by this idea that people take the unencumbered or undefined chaos of space and parcel it into livable chunks by erecting walls and windows and make a place for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, one of the things that I've also always been interested in are utopian ideals. And one of the things that most moves me about them is that they're always a failure. That even the most modern ideas of the ideal city or the ideal habitat becomes dated and ridiculous and inadequate in some way. And I find those two phenomena so extraordinary that people on one hand, certainly myself included, are so enamored of the idea of a safe place on one hand. And on the other hand, anybody who thinks about it realizes that there probably is no safe place.
Nothing is safe.
Right, exactly, no matter how thick those walls are or no matter how idealized the home or city in which one lives is.
Well, I began to think that these stories, in a sense, are a collaboration between the oddball and singular and the urge toward the conventional.
You know, it's the same dichotomy that exists between wanting to be mobile and wanting to have home. Mm-hmm. I mean, essentially, mm-hmm. it's the same thing. I often find a sort of inner battle going on in myself. On one hand, I love avant-garde art. I love the sense that art is this sort of ceaseless exploration of the odd and the anomalous and the eccentric. On the other hand, I can't help but be utterly in love with the joys of the conventional. I like, you know, TV. I like, you know, frozen food. I love a certain kind of regularity in my life.
But what I'm thinking of in particular here is a story in the new book, Guess Again. It's a story called Bit of Honey, in which a barber, taking his sheets home from the shop to clean, is in his car, drives past his father's house. He has not seen his father. His father has thrown him out years ago over a silly fight about traffic tickets. Not about homosexuality, not about the things you expect the fight might have actually been about. But seeing children on this Halloween night go in trick-or-treat, he decides to join them, puts one of the sheets from the barbershop over his head, and stands among the children asking his father for candy, eventually a bit of honey, and sneaks into the house. And I found myself thinking the difficulties between sons and fathers is a universal theme, and all of literature is a history of that theme in a sense. But this, as I was reading, was so particular and in life, it seemed to me, so unlikely that the story's job seemed to me to convince me, one, that such a thing could happen, and then afterwards to let its unlikeliness be meaningful. In other words, again, the oddball, the unusual, placed against the panorama of the universal. And I wondered about the risks taken by stories that circle their changes around very unlikely or contrived events.
That was the first story I wrote for this collection, and it actually, I mean, the idea arose independently from the following advice, but around that time, someone, a short story writer, who I was talking to, talked about this notion that you could write a short story by the process of trying to make something absolutely unlikely seem inevitable or reasonable. And I thought that was such an interesting idea. And not to digress too much into the genesis of that story, but I'm in the confessional mode at the moment. So I actually was estranged from my own father for a number of years, and one night had to drive past his house, the house where I grew up, and it was Halloween. I certainly did not do what the barber does in the story, but I saw my father's porch light on and knew that he was handing out candy to kids who were trick-or-treating in the neighborhood. And without incriminating myself too much here, the pang of childish jealousy and rage and longing that overtook me at that moment was really extraordinary. I wanted my daddy to give me candy, pure and simple.
Mm-hmm. Who wouldn't?
Well, especially a bit of honey. But
now we've gone through a bit of a process here. We started out with the idea of the stories as having somewhat verbal or even joke constructions. We've moved on to the idea that they have certain kinds of themes, fathers and sons, the need for security. Now, the third stage, in a way, that brings the Cooper story into its characteristic form is that these universal themes are approached from a gay perspective. And I wondered, how important is that to you as a writer? Many of the stories that you're writing are, in a sense, while they're not the kind of radical stories that gay fiction has been concerned with, they're in many cases the first time a gay story will be talking about the birth of a child to a heterosexual couple. Life itself is being put under this lens. And so many of these stories are reprinted in anthologies, largely because they're the first time a gay perspective is being offered on so-called mainstream materials. They're not so-called ghettoized stories. And I wondered if you could talk about that.
Yeah, this is a little bit of an oblique way to answer that question, but one of my favorite quotes by Flannery O'Connor, and there are many, is she was talking about morality. Someone had asked her if she kind of starts with a moral and spins a story from that. And she said that morality was the lens through which she looked, but it was not what she looked at. And I feel that homosexuality, that being queer is just that for me. It's a way of viewing the world. It's not always what I view. But I clearly am a product of a society in which people grow up and feel the potential to be ostracized, sort of out of it, anomalous, have to think pretty hard about the way they fit in, if they do fit in, if they ever will fit in. And those kinds of odd perspectives are not to romanticize any pain, but for me kind of a privilege as a writer, because I think all writers stand outside in some way and look in. I think there really is, if not gay content, then a gay perspective or sensibility in all the stories.
A final question. The earlier work in the first two books, Maps to Anywhere and A Year of Rhymes, tend, despite the fact of death of family members and other realities, tend to be more fanciful. They enter the realm of the imaginative. With Truth Serum, there's like a crash. And it seems as if it's not presumptuous to assume so, that the diagnosis with AIDS of your lover forces on you a reconsideration of what it is to write and who's being written to, what it's being written for, what its goals are. And I think that these stories in the new book, Guess Again, are very much still the result of that breakthrough. And I wanted to ask you about both the consequences and difficulties of such personal writing.
Again, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I've always been hyper aware of mortality, first of all, because it's my temperament. Second of all, because I grew up in a Jewish family where everyone was on the verge of death or illness, whether it was true or not, they swore they were. And also the deaths of my brothers at different points and all at a fairly young age. So that's nothing new, but I think that the kind of horrible gravity of things really does change with Truth Serum, and the kind of marker or determining factor really was losing friends and specifically the diagnosis of my partner. I'm in a sort of different couple. And I know that with Truth Serum, my interest in the memoir or the granted illusory idea that you could fix time, make fleeting experience somehow immutable by setting it down with words became so fierce and crucial for me. And it not only renewed my commitment to the form of the memoir at that point, a much maligned form nowadays, I think, but that's a whole other issue. But I really wanted to look at some of the things that were happening to me and to people around me head on, because I had such a sense that everything was expiring faster than I could record it. And that's a kind of unhappy motivation to work and to work hard and to try to capture and reflect on what's happening and will disappear at any moment. The specific piece that you're talking about in Truth Serum was a very complicated thing when I wrote about what it was like to be in the sort of different couple at that point. We were about 5 years into the relationship when Brian tested positive. And there were all sorts of challenges in that. One is that the nature of the illness changes so radically from day to day. It's so unpredictable. It's so exhausting that to try to write about it was a little bit like trying to shoot at a moving target. And it was ongoing. It wasn't something that I was looking at in retrospect. It was ongoing. And that made a huge difference. I also felt that I was responsible for his story as well as my own. At the same time, too, I think there's this interesting phenomena in any writing about AIDS, which is that there are a lot of very passionate beliefs out there about how AIDS should or shouldn't be written about, how it should be addressed. And one of my tasks as a writer always is to try to battle self-consciousness. I can't stand the idea that there's something I'm supposed to do. I need to kind of push away all the voices that are not my own until I see something clear that is my own. And so it was a real battle to, for example, dismiss something I read by Ed White, where he said that he felt that it was irresponsible somehow to deal with AIDS in a way that was humorous. I kind of have the feeling he would not support that idea any longer. But at the time, he was putting this idea forth. And there were plenty of others, conflicting ideas too. So it was odd to have so many voices of activists, of other writers, of people with AIDS playing around in my head and trying to take from it what I felt I needed and discard the rest. It made the process extremely complicated.
And in the current collection, what were the results of that writing? How do you feel that you've come full circle to an external short story, one that's not about yourself, but one that bears the lessons of the writings in Truth Serum?
Well, it seems to me this was the time where the experiences I've had, with AIDS, the way that AIDS has intruded on my life and the life of people I care about, that the time was really ripe to deal with it in fiction, because I've had, without getting out the violins here, I know so many people who've died and so many people who have and are suffering that it's hard to even remember them discreetly, because it's just such a pervasive mass of suffering. And rather than deal with specific stories, there was a way in which whole realms of feeling about AIDS could be channeled into fiction, into just making things up, taking parts of people's stories and completely fabricating things, to talk about how people have survived and continue to survive despite this kind of horror. It's kind of a dour note to leave things on, but it is a beautiful day out. I don't know.
I've been speaking to Bernard Cooper. His most recent book is a book of short stories called Guess Again, published by Simon & Schuster. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard with J.C. Swadek. Bernard, thank you for joining me.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Michael.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, what time?
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.